You know, the scripture is clear that sometimes we can sin by speaking, speaking wrongly, speaking untruthfully, speaking in such a way that doesn't reflect Christian love, in a way that isn't accurate.
Dr. Albert Mohler talking about his presentation at this year's Issues Etc. Making the Case conference.
But at the same time, it is also clear that it is unfaithfulness not to speak when we are called to speak. It's actually a sin not to speak when the truth requires that we speak, when courage requires that we speak. And one of the things we know is that the Christian church, as we look through the centuries, sometimes it has erred by speaking wrongly. Sometimes it has erred by speaking boldly or brashly, but it has often erred, especially as we think about our own times, by not speaking clearly, publicly, vocally, and biblically.
You can meet and hear Dr. Albert Mohler at the 2022 Making the Case Conference, June 24th and 25th in Chicago. Learn more at issuesetc.org. There was a time when you could rely on the fact that if you went to the doctor, he had your best interests at heart. Now, he might cause a little pain, who knows, give you a shot, maybe even surgery, but his goal was not to do you harm. His goal was to heal and help and treat and remediate whatever kind of illness or problem you had. It might be a rough road in that direction, but he was not there to do you harm. Can we still rely on that fact? Is that even a fact anymore in medicine in America? Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. on this Wednesday afternoon, May the 25th. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. Here in the first hour, we will hear Wesley Smith, Senior Fellow at the Discovery Institute Center on Human Exceptionalism, making the case for the Hippocratic Oath, Do No Harm, from the 2019 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference. And in hour two, it's What I Wish My Non-Lutheran Family Knew About Jesus with Pastor Brian Wolfmiller. Wesley Smith is Senior Fellow at the Discovery Institute Center on Human Exceptionalism. He's a consultant to the Patients' Rights Council, columnist for National Review Online, and author of several books, including Forced Exit, The War on Humans, and Culture of Death, The Age of Do Harm Medicine. Here he is making the case for the Hippocratic Oath.
Thank you, Pastor Todd. You know, I thought Pastor Todd liked me, and then he put me on after the hymns. Thanks very much. Who says Lutherans don't know how to have fun? Well, it's really a great pleasure to be here. I want to thank Todd. I want to thank Jeff. I want to thank Issues, etc. They've put me on the radio more times than I can tell you. I only have to pay them twice a year. And they've been very supportive of my work, and I deeply appreciate it. You know, the Hippocratic Oath is 2,500 years old. It predates Jesus Christ, 2,500 years old, and it comes out of a pagan culture in which Hippocrates understood some things that we seem to have forgotten today. For example, the Hippocratic Oath basically supports universal human equality. And think about that at a time 2,500 years ago when slavery was ubiquitous and women had no rights. And most people had no rights. The concept of rights itself may not have even existed except for the ruling class. And what did Hippocrates say? He made doctors in his school basically agree to never harm the patient. And he gave a few examples of what harming the patient could be. One, he said no abortion. Two, he said no euthanasia and assisted suicide. Three, he said, and this is remarkable when you read the document, that the doctor is to treat the slave master and the slave the same. And in that day and age, that was a very radical thing to conceive of. He created the idea of patient confidences and so forth. It is a very important document. And it is a document that, even though at the time it was created, it was sworn to the gods of Greece and so forth, that Christians throughout the centuries adopted into their own. Obviously not swearing to the gods, but changing the preamble, but maintaining the body of the Hippocratic Oath, because it is completely consistent with what we call Judeo-Christian moral belief, the sanctity of human life, the equality of human life. things that we in the West, Western civilization, have been working to attain and achieve for hundreds of years. But you know what? Todd said something that was overly optimistic. He said, your doctor probably took the Hippocratic Oath. No, your doctor probably didn't take the Hippocratic Oath. The Hippocratic Oath interferes with modern sophisticated sensibilities. And so medical school after medical school after medical school have watered it down, turned it into less distinct and less specific maxims. Yes, patient confidence remains. And there's generally this kind of very ephemeral idea of, well, you shouldn't hurt the patient. We will always do good, these kind of ideas. But those, the way the oaths are created today, it's almost just a symbol. Well, you're a doctor, so you take an oath. It's not the Hippocratic Oath anymore. And that's because we are moving away from the equality of life ethic, as I mentioned, the sanctity of life ethic, into what's called a quality of life ethic, where some people are deemed to have greater value than others. And in a medical context, that can't be more dangerous, because the people who are deemed to have less value are the ones who are going to get less quality care. And who has greater value and who has lesser value becomes an issue of power. Who has the power to decide? So how did we get to this place? And, you know, I started in fighting against euthanasia-assisted suicide back in 1993. My first article was published. It was published in Newsweek magazine. And I never dreamed that 26 years later I'd be still dealing with this issue. When I wrote this article, it's called The Whispers of Strangers. You can get it on the internet, do a Google search or a Bing search, Wesley J. Smith, Whispers of Strangers, and you'll see it'll come up. I thought it was completely non-controversial. I warned about what this movement was becoming, and the reason I brought it up is because I had a friend, her name was Frances, and Frances was a very depressed woman. She had one son who had been terribly injured in an auto accident and was profoundly disabled. She had another son who would not speak to her. I don't know what the circumstances were. Worst of all for Frances, her husband had left her for a younger woman. And she had been forced out of a very genteel way of living, way upper middle class, into a rent-controlled apartment in West Los Angeles. And making it worse for her, her husband came down with Alzheimer's, and so the hated second wife was writing her alimony checks. And she was bitter, and she was depressed, and she was angry. And she used to say, and I never understood what was going on, you know, I have my pills. I'll have my final exit, my final deliverance. I had no idea what she was talking about. She once decided she wanted to kill herself, and she invited, amazingly enough, all of her friends to come. Be in the living room with her. We would tell her what we thought of her, how much we loved her, why we cared about her. She would do the same for us, and then she would commit suicide. We said, are you out of your mind? And we all said, of course, we're not going to do that. We held an intervention. All kinds of things happened. Did you know that today suicide parties are held in states where assisted suicide and euthanasia is legal? Did you know that today the newspapers, and like the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, and some of the most major art outlets promote suicide parties, promote euthanasia parties? The very thing that Francis wanted us to do, and we refused, is now lauded as a virtue. Is now lauded as a virtue. So when Francis actually did something, she killed herself. She said, I had moved away from Los Angeles by this time, and I was living in the Bay Area, and her best friend called, and her best friend said, Wesley, Frances is talking about killing herself again. And I said, well, I'll call her, and I called her. I said, Frances, you can't do this. I said, at least see a psychiatrist. And she said, I don't want to see a psychiatrist because I'm afraid he'll give me a pill that will make me not want to kill myself. What does that tell you? Frances, who was an older woman, I'm getting close to where Frances was, so I should say, she was a young woman. was friends with my mother. They were contemporary at a contemporary age. And the funny thing is, when she would talk to me about my mother, she would say, "I talked to Mother, dear. You know, it was my mother." And they became friends. And my mother called and she said, "Francis called me and she said the suicide is off, that she'd had a divine revelation and she wasn't going to do it." And we all breathed a sigh of relief. Well, Francis was lying. Francis paid a cousin $5,000 to go with her to a hotel where she took an overdose of pills. And the cousin, I believe, obviously I don't know for sure, put a plastic bag over her head so that she would die, which she did. I then received the next day a suicide note. The return address just said Francis, as did all of her friends, basically stating, this is my final deliverance. I believe I'll be well remembered and so forth and so on. And everybody was terribly upset and terribly angry. And so something wasn't hitting me correctly. And I called her executress, this best friend who had called me to warn me that Francis was thinking of doing this. And she said, I want you to look for her suicide file, because Francis was the most organized person I've ever met. She had a file for everything. She had a Wesley file. She had my clippings because they were sent to me too, which was very nice, but she was dead, so it was very bittersweet. So this friend of hers sent me the suicide file that Francis had, and it was filled with pernicious suicide proselytizing literature, a new religion in essence. And it was put out by the Hemlock Society, which now calls itself Compassion and Choices, because they want to use nice gooey euphemisms to hide what they're really about, which is hemlock. When it was the Hemlock Society, at least it had the integrity to name itself honestly. And in these Hemlock Quarterlies, they taught Frances what drugs to take, and she'd underscored them in yellow. They taught her how to use that bag, and they had proselytizing stories. One of them I remember to this day. It said, "My loved one laughed and giggled and seemed to relish the experience." That sound you heard was my head exploding, because we were talking about suicide, laughing and giggling. Oh, I've been relishing the experience of killing myself, please. But what that Hemlock Quarterly was doing was proselytizing and pushing and promoting and saying suicide is good, suicide is right, suicide is empowering. And I was so upset by that, and being a writer, I had the opportunity to vent, if you will, and I wrote that piece, The Whispers of Strangers, which I thought was completely not controversial. And in this article back in 93, June 28, 1993, I remember the date because my life changes because of this article in a way I never anticipated or ever dreamed would happen. I warned that if we decided that some people are disposable, if we decided that some of us, when they become suicidal, rather than getting preventive services, that we should give facilitation, that we will soon decide, well, they've got some pretty good organs. Maybe we should get those too. And so I warned, if we go down this road, people like Frances would be a victim because she romanticized the idea of suicide. And then she would do it, and then pretty soon there would be an attempt to make society have a stake in people killing themselves through organ donation. I was called an alarmist. I was told I was an hysteric. I'm a paranoid. Well, just because you're paranoid, that doesn't mean they're not really after you. And so as I got into this, because I got so much hate mail, now realize I got 150 letters. I received 150 hate mail letters, most of them hate mail, about 10 or 15 weren't, 20 maybe. And this is at a time when you wanted to tell somebody that you hope they get cancer, that you had to take something called a piece of paper, and you had to put it in either to a typewriter or use something called a pen, and you wrote it on the symbols on the paper, and then you took something called an envelope and you folded it and you put it in this thing, and you actually had to pay money to tell the person you hope he gets cancer with something called a stamp. Now, this is before the email links. And I received 150 letters, most of which were really nasty, awful, telling me that Francis was good, that Francis was right. Euthanasia is the future. I hope you get cancer and die. I hope you get cancer and don't die and linger and so forth and so on. And I thought, what happened to my culture and where was I when it happened? I was so stunned by this. And so that's when I decided that I was going to shift gears from what I was doing. At that time, I was writing books with Ralph Nader and focus on this issue. And so I got into fighting euthanasia and assisted suicide, which got me into understanding the evil that this way comes, that is being promoted by utilitarian bioethics, which is not unanimous, but, and this that's what we'll be talking to when I get through with my introduction. Get the hook. It made me see that what was happening in healthcare was really awful and ugly because we were losing that Hippocratic value system. And it was endangering people who are unable to care for themselves equally. People with disabilities, the elderly, people with serious illnesses, the mentally ill. And getting back to that organ harvesting thing, in Belgium and in the Netherlands, mentally ill people without physical diseases, psychiatric patients, when they want to die, if the psychiatrist says, yes, I think you should die because your suffering is too bad, they go to a hospital. And they're not dying imminently. They're only going to die because they go to the hospital, not to be healed, but to be killed. And in Belgium, they will then put them on a table. They'll stick a line in their veins. They will pour poison into the veins. The patient dies. 2 minutes later, that patient is wheeled into an operating theater, and the organs are removed and harvested. Everything that I warned about in 93 is happening. Now, it's not because I'm a prophet. It's because I have a logical mind. Once you say that a group is killable, which is what we're talking about, then they also become oppressed, oppressible, and exploitable, and can become to be seen as a natural resource ripe for the harvest, which is what is happening. I have a paper out today, if you'll go on to American Spectator, and it deals with Canada, which now has lethal injection euthanasia. And whenever I would bring up Belgium and the Netherlands and the euthanasia debates, my opponents would say, oh, well, that's them. This is the United States. We'd never do it here. Well, Canada is our closest cultural cousin. If we'd won the Battle of Quebec, they'd be part of the United States. They not only have lethal injection euthanasia throughout the country, but their medical establishment has just published a guidance for the terms by which euthanasia patients, I use the term in quotes, patients, can be killed and harvested. We're talking about killing and harvesting human beings. With their consent for now anyway, but you're still talking about killing and harvesting human beings who may decide that their life isn't worth living, and since they can donate their organs, that might be actually the tipping point that says to them, that have them think, my death has greater value than my life. What could be more cruel? And I noticed in that guidance, there was not one thing in there about doctors, when a patient comes in and says, I want to be killed, well, let's get suicide prevention going. Let's get multidisciplinary team in here to help people get through the darkness. Not a mention of that. There's plenty of mention of organs and how they'll be good organs, you know? So everything that I worried about and warned about has been happening because it's logical, because we take a premise and we take it where it leads. Now, some people would say, how did we get to this place? And I used to have that question all the time too, you know. Wait a minute, how did we get to the why now question? Have you ever asked the why now question? The why now question is, you know, 100, 150 years ago, if somebody got bone cancer, they would die in agony. If somebody got an appendicitis attack and their appendix burst, they would die in agony. And there was no talk then of euthanasia and death with dignity. Did you know that in the 1880s, 1890s, the term euthanasia meant a good death, natural death, surrounded by your family in a state of grace? That was euthanasia. And the very first euthanasia activists, as they always do, hijacked that perfectly good word and turned it into mercy killing, being killed as a means of alleviating suffering. So I had this, why now? You know, now, today, we can, you don't die in agony. We have the means of saying that that patients can be palliated. They can be receive hospice care. When it's both my parents died with hospice care. Tremendous benefit to them and to me. And I just never was able to deal with the why now question. And then I read a book called Imagining the Future by a fellow named Yuval Levin, L-E-V-I-N. He's a protege of Leon Cass. Leon Cass led the President's Council on Bioethics under George W. Bush. I actually was not on that council. I was really happy Todd gave me a promotion, but I knew people on it. But Leon was the head, and he's a wonderful bioethicist who does not go along with the mainstream view. And of course, not every bioethicist does. For example, I'm sure an LCMS Lutheran bioethicist would never agree with the things I'm talking about. And bioethics is not a monolith, but it is becoming an orthodoxy in terms of the mainstream view. So if you don't have a modifier in front of the term, such as a Lutheran bioethicist or Catholic bioethicist or perhaps conservative or human rights bioethicist, generally speaking, they will go along with all of what I'm going to describe in a few minutes if I ever get to it, or at least most of it. And so I read The Primary Good, and it was a book about the stem cell issue, which we're not going to get into today, and it tried to explain to conservatives why liberals felt the way they did about the embryonic stem cell issue and vice versa. But Yuval Levin had a little bit in here that really answered the why now question, and I'd like to share it with you because it'll explain what's going on here, and it'll explain how people can decide that they think it is actually a good thing. I mean, these people don't think they're evil. They don't think they're wrong. They don't think that this is bad. They think it's good. Well, these people want to die. We have to respect personal autonomy. And of course, just think of the people we can save with the organs that we would go to waste if we let them not donate. Well, the answer, of course, isn't to let them donate. The answer is not to kill them. But once you've accepted the premise that killing is the right answer, well, then everything follows from it. And so he wrote this. He wrote about Descartes. Descartes, he says, was awfully bold in describing health as, quote, without doubt the primary good and the foundation of all other goods of this life, unquote. Then Yuval Levin goes on to say, surely the claim that health is the primary good has consequences well beyond the agenda of the scientist. Any society's understanding of the foundational good necessarily gives shape to its politics, its social institutions, and its sense of moral purpose and direction. How you live has a lot to do with what you strive for. And health is an unusual candidate for the primary good. It is surely an essential good. Without health, not much else can be enjoyed. But Descartes' formulation in the worldview of modern science sees health not only as a foundation, but also a principal goal. Not only as a beginning, but also an end. And this is the key. Relief and preservation from disease and pain, from misery and necessity, become the defining ends of human action, and therefore human societies. I should have had a V8, right? What Yuval Levin is saying is that for many people, the primary purpose of society is no longer defending the weak and defenseless, their lives, or promoting righteousness. It is eliminating suffering. And if eliminating suffering becomes the prime directive, that very quickly morphs into eliminating the sufferer. And if you decide that eliminating the sufferer is acceptable, then the very things that the suffering that would justify the elimination stretches and becomes very elastic. Let me give you an example. My mother died of Alzheimer's disease, age 99, had all her own teeth. Now, the funny thing about Mom is she'd always wanted to live to be 100. And when she had her 99th birthday, my wife and I brought her into our home so that we could care for her at the end. When she had her 99th birthday, we knew she wasn't going to make it to 100 unless there had been a divine intervention or something. And so we hatched a plot. We said, we'll tell Ma you're in your 100th year, which was not a lie, right? So we went, Ma, Ma, you're in your 100th year. And my mother had really bad Alzheimer's, and she looked at me and she says, don't give me that. I tried. But my mother, when we brought her home, my mother suffered with Alzheimer's. There's no question my mother suffered. Now, the good part for her is the next morning she'd forget it. She had what's called sundowning, so that when this, I don't understand how this or why this would work, but when the sun would come down, Alzheimer's would come out like a dragon and really do, I'm not going to go into details, but it was awful. It was terrible. Then the next morning I'd say, Ma, do you remember what happened last night? She'd go, no, I did. So I suffered too, right? I suffered. So should my suffering be part of the justification for killing somebody like my mother? There are many in bioethics who would say yes. Who else suffers? Well, a lot of the medical people who take care of people with dementia suffer. It's a very difficult ministry, and it's a very difficult area of practice, because you see people who have, you know, had these full lives who are losing their capacities, and that's very difficult. Or imagine being a pediatric oncologist and watching children with cancer and so forth. I mean, my hat's off to the people in healthcare. And if I made any implication that there's an immorality in healthcare, if there is, it's not because of the people who work in it. Because the people who work in it, the doctors, the nurses, the people who are there on the trenches, they're the ones who are keeping healthcare moral. They're the ones who are keeping the spirit of Hippocrates alive. But it's very hard for healthcare. So should the suffering of the healthcare workers, the doctors and the nurses, should that justify euthanasia and assisted suicide? Some have said it should.
We're listening to Wesley Smith of the Discovery Institute Center on Human Exceptionalism, making the case for the Hippocratic Oath from the 2019 Issues Etc. Making the Case conference. He's going to get into the other costs of euthanasia after the break. You can meet and hear Bill Barr, Albert Moeller, Pavi Rossinen, Chris Roseborough, Brian Wolfmiller, Joel Bierman, and Will Whedon at the 2022 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, Friday, June 24th and Saturday, June 25th in Chicago. For more information, visit issuesetc.org or call 618-223-8385. The 2022 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, June 24th and 25th at Concordia University, Chicago.
This fallen creation is bested by tornado, hurricane, flood, pandemic, and more. LCMS Disaster Response helps our congregations, their pastors, and other church workers to reach out to their members and neighbors with mercy which flows from Christ's altar. We offer quality volunteer training, help for congregational readiness and response, and disaster grant funding. To learn more, visit lcms.org/disaster. That's lcms.org/disaster.
Essential exercise for the Christian mind. You're listening to Issues Etc.
We desire for all Christian children, including those with learning or behavior challenges, to receive a strong education in the faith. At simplyclassical.com, you will find reading, penmanship, and copybook exercises based on the truth, wisdom, and comfort of God's Word. We include Aesop's Fables and classic children's literature, math and science, all from Memoria Press. Use promo code LPR22 at simplyclassical.com.
Wesley Smith is making the case for the Hippocratic Oath from the 2019 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. What are the other costs of euthanasia?
What about the cost to society? The cost of care? We have people who say there should be health care rationing because we have to stop we have to control health care costs as they keep expanding the jurisdiction of health care, which is another speech altogether. Should that justify euthanasia? Well, when Vermont passed a bill in its state that would have legalized a single-payer health care plan, and I'm not getting into the politics of that, but a single-payer health care plan for Vermont. They had a problem figuring out how they were going to pay for it, and guess what editorialists were saying should be the reason how you pay for it? Healthcare rationing and assisted suicide. Because it may cost $1,000 for an assisted suicide or a euthanasia. It could cost $100,000 of care, so somebody doesn't want that. And so the economic gravity is very clear. So when you get to the situation where you've done away with the idea that the primary purpose of society, or even, let's say, healthcare with the Hippocratic Oath, is no longer to protect the lives of each and every patient equally, but to eliminate suffering, and we get to eliminating the sufferer, you go down two different paths. So, you know, if you're going to take a path friend that has a one degree of separation as you walk, for the longest time you're going to be able to talk to each other and have a conversation because it takes a long time before you hear from each other. But eventually you're on the other side of the planet. And that's where we are now. And as to be optimistic, because Lutherans are always optimistic, right? Yeah! The game is still afoot. The good guys have not lost, and the good guys are the Hippocratic Oath believers. People who believe in human equality. The contest is on. And I believe strongly that if people can understand what the contest is, it'll be a rout, and we won't be the losers. The problem is getting through the media smokescreen, is going for clicks and emotion, and it's very hard to have a long-term discussion. My friend Ralph Nader once said something to me, and this is very true. He said, "Wesley, I used to be able to go on the television and I'd get a 45-second soundbite on the TV news, and of course you can say, you know, a lot in 45 seconds, unless you're me." And he said, "Now it's 10 seconds. He said, "Pretty soon I expect I'll go on a TV or radio show and they'll ask me a question and they'll say, go, for yes and for no." Because that's where we're at. And it precludes and it inhibits a full discussion and debate and engagement in these issues. So where might the eliminating suffering school lead us? We don't have to guess, because the people who espouse those values actually write a lot of articles about it. And it's up in the journals, the medical journals, the professional journals, that the popular media doesn't cover. And most people don't ever read or don't even know about. So I read it, and I try to bring it to people so that people can be aware of what is being planned for us. And what is being planned for us is a value system that most of us don't agree with. And this is a really good example. This was an article published by a bioethicist from the UK named Alastair Cochrane, C-O-C-H-R-A-N-E. It's in a journal called Bioethics, and it was December 2009. And his idea was, he promoted what he called an undignified bioethics, by which he meant that human beings do not have intrinsic dignity. Okay? Equality, sanctity of life says that we each have intrinsic dignity that comes simply and merely from being human, which I accept, and that's what we promote in the Center on Human Exceptionalism at the Discovery Institute. So the reason I want to read from this is because he makes such a good argument for the sanctity, equality of life before he rejects it, that I want to share it with you, because he's written it better than I ever have. And let me go into this. First, he talks a bit about dignity. Now, he says this, we're not talking about dignified behavior. Of course, human beings can act in an undignified way. Just ask my wife when she dances with me. You know, whoops, sorry, honey. So when I dance, I'm not dignified. I'm like Elaine on Seinfeld. You know? All right, but that's not the dignified or dignity we're talking about. Every one of us in some form or fashion in our lives has not acted in a dignified manner. Second, now he goes on, the second concept of dignity that we need to consider does not see dignity as a form of behavior, Wesley dancing, but as a property. Under this conception, the possession of dignity by humans signifies that they have an inherent moral worth. In other words, because human beings possess dignity, we cannot do what we like to them, but instead have direct moral obligations toward them. Indeed, this understanding of dignity is usually considered to serve as the grounding for human rights. As Article 1 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights states, all human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights. That's right. So what he's saying is, if you believe in human dignity as an intrinsic aspect of human beings, none of us are objects, we're all subjects. None of us can become exploitable. We're all in. We're all us. There's no them. There's only us. And of course, that's the problem we've been working on for millennia. How do we make us all understand that we're all us? He goes on to say, this conception of dignity as inherent moral worth certainly seems coherent enough as an idea, you think? Indeed, we can also see why this conception of dignity is employed in certain debates around bioethics. For if all individual human beings possess dignity, then they should not be viewed simply as resources that we can treat however we please. No corn crop ripe for the harvest, right? To take an example, then, it might be that we could achieve rapid and significant progress in medical science if we were to conduct wide-ranging medical experiments on groups of human beings. However, because human beings have dignity, so it is argued, this means that they possess a particular quality that grounds certain moral obligations and rights. Exactly. Exactly. I don't understand how anyone could be against that, but he is. He goes on to say, right, if all human beings possess dignity, this extraordinary moral worth, now he's getting sarcastic, we need some explanation of what it is about the species Homo sapiens that make them so deserving. When we start looking at a particular characteristic that might ground dignity, language use, moral action, sociality, sentience, self-consciousness, and so on, we soon see that none of these qualities are in fact possessed by each and every human. We are therefore left wondering why all human beings actually do possess dignity. This is a game of what I call the philosopher and the dupe. The philosopher says, what is it that makes human beings have this intrinsic moral dignity? Now, everyone in here would say, we have souls, we're made in the likeness and image of God. The philosopher says, I don't believe in God. So how do you go on? You have to go on. And so let's say moral agency. Only human beings truly understand the concepts of right and wrong, which is how we create laws, how we have ethics, and so forth, moral codes. The philosopher then says, you're right, that does distinguish human beings, but not every human being has that capacity of right and wrong. A non-born baby can't determine right and wrong. A newborn infant can't determine right and wrong. Somebody with a serious mental illness, Wesley's mother at the end, can't determine right or wrong. Therefore, it's all baloney. No, you see, the ability to determine right or wrong is inherent in the human being, inherent in our nature. And if it cannot be expressed, it's only because it is being artificially impeded or impeded by immaturity. Either the newborn baby can't do it because of immaturity. My mother couldn't do it because her brain had a terrible injury caused by the Alzheimer's disease that did not change who she was as an intrinsic human being. Moreover, even if you won't accept that concept, if we say that we're going to determine what these moral values are moment by moment by moment, because that's what he's talking about. You have to measure the individual's capacity for this ability. That means none of us is safe, because we may have that ability today, and tomorrow we may trip and hit our head and lose that ability. And so what he's saying is, today you have that ability, yes, you have value, you trip and you hurt your head and you're cognitively disabled, now you don't have that value. Now you have lesser value. Now you become killable. Now you become exploitable. Now you become harvestable. That's not a free society. That's not a moral society. That's not a good society. So the danger in the idea of we're going to measure ourselves individually is really pronounced. And it is the end of universal human rights, because universal human rights, as he admitted in this piece, is based on equal moral worth of every human being simply and merely because we're human. That's the question of the 21st century. And in many ways, it was the question of the 20th century. Remember eugenics? Remember Jim Crow? In many ways, it was the question of the 18th century. Remember slavery? So it's been the question that has haunted us for a long time. And we were just getting to the point where maybe we're finally going to reach the promised land, to use that metaphor, and now these bioethicists want to take us backwards. It's not racism, but it's people with a less ability to defend themselves than racial minorities. But it's the same victimization, it's the same invidiousness, it's the same oppression, it's the same, if I will say, bigotry. He goes on to say, obviously, given controversies over abortion, stem cell research, genetic interventions, animal experimentation, euthanasia, and so on, bioethics does need to engage in debates over which entities possess moral worth and why. But these are best conducted by using the notion of moral status and arguing over the characteristics that warrant possession of it. Simply stipulating that all and only human beings possess this inherent moral worth because they have dignity is arbitrary and unhelpful. It's unhelpful if you don't want to kill and harvest. I mean, it's unhelpful if you do want to kill and harvest. It's unhelpful if you do want to be able to create human lives for the purpose of experimenting on them in stem cell research and human cloning research. It's unhelpful if you want to take somebody like Terry Schiavo with a serious cognitive incapacity and decide that instead of dehydrating her to death over 2 weeks, which you wouldn't do to a convicted terrorist and shouldn't do to a convicted terrorist, that if you did it to a dog, you would go to jail. But when you did it to Terry Schiavo because she had a cognitive incapacity, it was called medical ethics. It's unhelpful if you want to go down that route. Yes. But if you want a healthcare system in which each and every one of us is approached by the doctor, by the nurse, by the healthcare administrator as deserving of optimal care and equal moral worth, it's essential. And it's essential if you want to live in a society that actually believes and practices in universal human rights. Time is moving along, as it often does, and I want to get to a lot of things. But I won't get to them all. Let me show you just a real quick example of the kind of measurement that many in bioethics wish to pursue in determining who has value and who doesn't, who has greater worth and who has lesser worth, who cannot be exploited and who can be. And it's called the concept of being a person. Now, most of us understand the idea of person, it would be a synonym with being human, and we're all persons. That's not how it's looked upon in mainstream bioethics. In mainstream bioethics, it's a subjective issue by which you have to basically earn your status of being a person with certain cognitive capacities, such as being self-aware over time or being able to value your own life, this kind of thing. This is an article written in the Kennedy Institute of Ethics Journal back in 1999. The Kennedy Institute of Ethics Journal is on the Georgetown University campus. It is one of the major bioethical journals in the world. And the fellow who wrote this is John Harris. He's a very influential bioethicist over in the UK, very involved in their National Healthcare Service, which is a frightening prospect, and their healthcare rationing in the United Kingdom. And he writes, many, if not most, of the problems of healthcare ethics presuppose that we have a view about what sorts of beings have something that we might think of as ultimate moral value. Or if this sounds too apocalyptic, then we certainly need to identify those sorts of individuals who have the highest moral value or importance. Do you see what he just said? He has just said that we're going to create the invidious categories of discrimination, that some people will be deemed to have the highest value and other people won't. As I said before, that's no different than racism, just different victims. Same thing. Harris goes on to say, personhood provides a species-neutral way of, why would he say that? Because in this personhood theory idea, there are some animals that are deemed to have greater value than humans if their mental capacities are greater than the human. So in this idea of personhood theory, many bioethicists, not all, even within mainstream bioethics, not all, but many, Peter Singer, how many of you have heard of Peter Singer? He's the chief proponent at Princeton University. He wasn't brought from Australia to Princeton in spite of these views, but because of them. And that's our most prestigious university in the country, secular. almost, that was close. So he says, personhood provides a species-neutral way of grouping creatures that have lives that would be wrong to end by killing or by letting die. These may include animals, machines, extraterrestrials, gods, angels, and devils. You have to have a big brain to say something like that.
We're listening to Wesley Smith make the case for the Hippocratic Oath from the 2019 Issues Etc. Making the Case conference. He'll take up the subject of transhumanism after the break. Issues Etc. guests are frequent contributors to the Lutheran Witness magazine. The Lutheran Witness is a must-have resource for every Issues Etc. listener. You can receive an annual print and digital subscription for less than $20. Learn more at cph.org/witness or by calling Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040. Interpreting the world from a Lutheran perspective, the Lutheran Witness magazine. cph.org/witness or 1-800-325-3040.
Please know that you are welcome at Ascension Lutheran Church in Niles.
We believe that every word of Holy Scripture is true.
Jesus died and rose again for your salvation.
We pray for each other. It's a priority.
We help each other in times of need.
We help each other grow in faith.
We encourage one another.
We truly love one another.
We have room for you and those you love.
Ascension Lutheran Church.
Niles and Annoy.
Your comprehensive source for information, teaching, and truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Have you ever wondered why Jesus ascended into the heavens? Why does he leave his disciples behind? Why not stay here on earth and rule and govern his church here on earth? Well, if you've ever wondered this question, you need to pick up your copy of the May issue of the Lutheran Witness, where we talk about the Ascension, how to recover Ascension Day services in your own congregation, Ascension Day hymnody, and so much more. To order your copy, visit cph.org/witness or visit our website, witness.lcms.org, to learn more. The Lutheran Witness, helping you interpret the world from a Lutheran perspective.
Do you know any military veterans in your church or community? Do you have a passion to support and reach them with the gospel of Jesus Christ? Then Operation Barnabas is for you. Called by Christ's love, Operation Barnabas engages, empowers, and equips LCMS faith communities to provide hope, healing, and support to military-connected persons living in their community. Operation Barnabas is a program of LCMS Ministry to the Armed Forces. Find out more at lcms.org/armedforces.
Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're listening to Wesley Smith of the Discovery Institute making the case for the Hippocratic Oath from the 2019 Issues Etc. Making the Case conference. Next, Wesley takes up the subject of transhumanism.
How many of you have heard of transhumanism? This is a whole other speech, but transhumanism is a futuristic philosophy that seeks to seize control of human evolution and create a post-human species, of course, of superior people. It's eugenics writ modern. It's the Superman theory of having a super race and so forth. It also believes that it will be able to prevent people from dying. It's a materialistic religion that seeks to supplant the hope of Christianity with the hope of technology. And I don't have time to get into that, but read on transhumanism. But that's where they talk in transhumanism. They're going to upload their consciousnesses into computers, and then these computers will be on robots, and the robots will be machines, and they'll be persons too. I chide them. I'll say, guess what? If you upload your consciousness into a computer, it's not you. It's just software. You're not dead, alive, you're gone. They don't like that. I have fun with them. Then he goes on to say, persons who want to live are wrong by being killed because they are thereby deprived of something they value. Persons who do not want to live are not on this account harmed by having their wish to die granted through voluntary euthanasia, for example. Non-persons or potential persons, what's a potential person, Wesley? Potential persons in bioethics are newborn babies. Because you can't say that they're not human beings, which they are. And in this bioethics theory, an infant is not yet a person because they have not yet attained those capacities I mentioned. So they call them potential persons because they try to get out of the consequences of this personhood theory that you could actually mean you could kill babies, right? Or that you could harvest babies. So that's what a potential person is. Non-persons, who would be like Terry Schiavo, or potential persons, like a baby, cannot be wronged in this way because death does not deprive them of anything they can value. If they cannot wish to live, they cannot have that wish frustrated by being killed. These are the people who are teaching the doctors of tomorrow. These are the people who are teaching the nurses of tomorrow. These are the people who are teaching the healthcare administrators of tomorrow and the business leaders of tomorrow and the government leaders of tomorrow. And it's really frightening because it moves us away from the understanding of Judeo-Christianity and Western civilization that each and every one of us has equal inherent moral worth simply and merely because we're human. Our value is objective, not subjective. And without that, you're not going to have freedom. You're just not. It's going to be an issue of who has the power, which has been the bane of human civilization since we were kicked out of the Garden of Eden. Now, this is another fellow named Tom Beauchamp, co-authored the most important textbook in bioethics called The Principles of Biomedical Ethics. And he says, because many humans lack properties of personhood or less than full persons, they are thereby rendered equal or inferior in moral standing to some non-humans, as I mentioned before. If this conclusion is defensible, well, we will need to rethink our traditional view that these unlucky humans cannot be treated in the ways we treat relevantly similar non-humans. For example, they might be aggressively used as human research subjects and sources of organs. So you see the darkness that this way comes and where this leads. Where this leads. It leads to things that I can only define as evil. If you're going to experiment on a cognitively disabled human being and call yourself moral, you're lying to yourself. You're lying to yourself because we have rejected that thing very forcibly in the past. And now we're going to embrace it because we're going to say some of us aren't really human, because that's basically what they're saying. They can't do it logically because, of course, biologically, they're human beings, so they say, well, we'll just decide on this idea of personhood. Where does this lead? It can lead to infanticide. For example, Peter Singer, who I mentioned before, wrote in his book Practical Ethics, in favor of infanticide, when the death of a disabled infant will lead to the birth of another infant with better prospects of a happy life, the total amount of happiness will be greater if the disabled infant is killed. The loss of a happy life for the first infant is outweighed by the gain of a happier life for the second. Therefore, if killing the hemophiliac infant has no adverse effect on others, what about the baby? It would, according to the total view, if I had a pipe, I'd smoke it, be right to kill him. Realize what Peter Singer, who is at Princeton University, who is the favorite philosopher of the New York Times, who is quoted continually as this paragon of ethics, what he's saying there. He is saying that if a baby is born disabled and the parents think they might want to have another child, well, let's kill this baby so that when the second child comes along, that second child won't be burdened by having a disabled sibling. That's what he's saying. It's not even killing the baby to protect people who are already here. He's talking about a prospect of killing for a prospective birth that may or may not ever happen. And there has been other, it's not just Peter Singer, there have been other advocacies in, like, the Journal of Medical Ethics for infanticide. It's called Afterbirth Abortion. This is the paper. You can see it's been marked up a bit. Afterbirth abortion, why should the baby live? If you have to ask that question, you have no business writing in a learned journal. And they basically say that I got 1 minute? Says who? All right, I won't go there because I've only got 1 minute, which will be 10, but you can see the examples of infanticide. This is an article, Advanced Directives Dementia, which argues that if somebody gets Alzheimer's like my mother did, and that the person, when they were competent, wrote an advanced directive, advanced healthcare directive, to be starved to death by caregivers, that should be followed. And we're not talking about a feeding tube, we're talking about spoon feeding. So that even if the person with Alzheimer's, let's say they say, if I forget my son, which my mother did, and at that point I don't want to live, my caregivers must stop feeding me and giving me water. And even if I'm taking it willingly, they should stop. That's not legal yet, but it is being promoted. This is the kind of thing that this idea brings us to. And I'm going to just take 5 minutes from the Q&A because this is important, and then I will close up. Where does this lead to? Is there a duty to die? Do some of us have a duty to die and get out of the way? There was a governor in Colorado who talked about elderly people in that way a few decades ago. And this is an article written by John Hardwick in the Hastings Center Report, and that's important because the Hastings Center Report is the most prestigious bioethics journal in the world. He asks, is there a duty to die? Guess what the answer is. A duty to die becomes greater as you grow older. To have reached the age of, say, 75 or 80 years without being ready to die is itself a moral failing. The sign of a life out of touch with life's basic realities. You know, when the Culture of Death book I first wrote in 2001, and it was called The Assault on Medical Ethics in America because it was a warning of what was coming. When we revised it and updated it 2 years ago, we changed the subtitle to The Age of Do Harm Medicine because it's here. This isn't here yet, but much of what I warned about and what I've discussed, for example, taking organs from euthanasia victims, is here. And in interviewing Hardwick, we had a long talk, and he said, well, what if your mother, and I'm not kidding, he said this, and it's in the book, the revised edition, what if your mother gets Alzheimer's, Wesley, and because she has Alzheimer's, you're not able to do as much writing as you used to do or as much traveling for public speaking as you used to do. Don't you think she should have a duty to die? I went through that very thing, and hell no is my answer. Hell no, my mother didn't have a duty to die. I had a duty to take care of her.
Wesley Smith is senior fellow at the Discovery Institute's Center on Human Exceptionalism. He's consultant to the Patients' Rights Council, columnist for National Review Online, author of several books including Forced Exit, The War on Human Rights, and Culture of Death, The Age of Do Harm Medicine. Pastor Brian Wolf-Miller joins us after the break to talk about what he wishes his non-Lutheran family knew about Jesus.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues, Etc.